Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of a recent episode exploring the history of investors holding businesses accountable and the dawn of the ESG, or Environmental Social Governance, movement.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. Today's show may not prove suitable for all listeners. Death by suicide is increasingly a leading cause of death in the United States. A tough topic. And yet we intend this hour to offer valuable insight and resources, and even hope itself, to people who are hurting badly. In February 2017, Jennifer Ashton's husband of 22 years took his own life by jumping off the George Washington Bridge. They had divorced 2 weeks before. Shock was followed by unimaginable grief. And yet, along with her children, Ashton has found her way toward experiencing joy and human connection. This hour on Point, ABC News chief medical correspondent Jennifer Ashton on life after suicide. We'll offer a few resources throughout the hour, and we'll have more on our website, which we welcome you to visit, onpointradio.org, if you or someone you know may be considering taking his or her life. So please contact, in that case, the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-8255 or the Crisis Text Line by texting 741-741. And we welcome you to join us. What questions do you have about processing the shock, grief, and anger after a loved one's suicide? How have you coped with the tragedy of losing a friend or family member? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me here in studio in New York City is Dr. Jennifer Ashton. She is ABC News' chief medical correspondent, also a board-certified OBGYN. Her new book is called Life After Suicide, Finding Courage, Comfort, and Community After Unthinkable Loss. She also has an eight-part series podcast entitled Life After Suicide. Jennifer, welcome to On Point.
Thank you so much for having me, David.
So, you know, as tough as this is, walk us a little bit through this. What led up? What was your life like up to the point at which your longtime husband, ex-husband Rob, took his life?
Well, working backwards from February of 2017, David, I had actually done, I was thinking, a pretty good job of kind of the optics of perfection, and not optics to the external world, but optics for myself, really. It was a coping mechanism that I had developed after my parents divorced when I was pretty young, when I was 5 years old. And I learned, after now a lot of therapy, that that coping mechanism of uber achieving and setting a bar high for myself and achieving all of these measures of success in my mind was a way to keep my father's love. This was all a response to my parents' divorce. So that was kind of in my inner psyche. And
that's how you were built.
Exactly.
The idea, and it's a theme in your book, the idea of perfection. I've got this. Not only do I have this down, I've got it nailed.
Exactly. And that's really important in the post-suicide Jennifer Ashton, because as I think we'll talk about and as you see in the book, it's hard to heal and recover from something that shatters you to your core if your optics of perfection are still kind of driving that train. So, you know, but even the divorce, I had said, okay, our marriage ended, so do 60% of other marriages. I want to do divorce better than anyone has ever done divorce. And Rob and I were proud of having what we called an evolved divorce. No screaming, no ugliness, no, you know, eviscerating each other. And I thought we were in the clear. And then 18 days later, he killed himself.
Which must have been absolutely staggering. He did it in a way that was also hard for you to avoid, mm-hmm. you know, and it was something where you had to think about both what he had done, that is off the bridge, which is near your place mm-hmm. in New Jersey, mm-hmm. but also that he did it. It seemed as though in reading your book, it is as though it exemplified the idea he did it under your eyes. That is, that this was playing out. You hadn't perceived that this was likely to happen.
Right.
Even though you're not a psychiatrist,
right.
but you are kind of adjacent to that. You
right.
deal with people. You deal with symptoms. You deal
right.
with signs. You didn't detect any of that.
No. I mean, you know, in medical school, whatever your specialty is, we're all taught the signs of major depression, and Rob had none of them, zero, not a single one. Even when we were going through couples therapy before our divorce, our therapist asked both of us if we would ever or could imagine ever having suicidal thoughts, and we both said emphatically no. And Rob and I were texting the day before he died. We had seen each other 3 days before at our daughter's ice hockey game. And so not only did it come out of the blue, but you're right. It was right in front of us, literally. I was driving over the George Washington Bridge less than 20 minutes before he jumped off of it. And I think that there are kind of pros and cons to that, actually. I mean, it, as in our face as it was, the method that he chose, there, I think there were also some considerations to us in that he would have never chosen a way that would have led to me or my children having to find him. So, you know, kind of six to one, half dozen to the other.
So how did you process? You describe in the book sort of people, waves of people coming over to your house, but how did you actually in your mind and your heart process this?
I couldn't really. I mean, I think that, you know, anyone who's gone through a sudden trauma like this, you know, it becomes almost Hollywood-like, you know, the knock on the door, the detectives coming into my apartment, hearing those words, and then everything kind of going black and shattering and collapsing to my knees. You know, I mean, many, many, many people have gone through, unfortunately, something like that. I think I processed it in waves, you know, and stages. Initially, I would say for at least 2 weeks, there was true psychological shock, which also had physiologic manifestations, which as a medical doctor, I had never experienced and I didn't even really know existed. So not being able to sleep more than 2 hours at a time, even with medication, losing 9 pounds in less than 2 weeks, feeling physical pain and looking for bruises, even though there were none. I mean, all of those were kind of the first stage, and then it kind of went into another stage and another stage, and it's still ongoing.
And you talk about this, dealing with this for yourself, dealing with this through therapy, dealing this with your two children, mm-hmm. who were, I think, 17 and 18 at the time this happened.
Exactly.
And how hard that was for you trying to work with them and at the same time really processing and not processing this yourself.
Yeah, I mean, I think that any parent, but especially mothers, there's a maternal instinct that I really do believe is hardwired and kicks in situations of trauma like this where your only focus is protecting your children. And so I had already kind of collapsed psychologically and physically with the realization that I was not able to protect them from pain, right? Because they had just lost their father. But then my focus, my sole focus became not decompensating in front of them so that they would think now they've lost both parents. And that means physically as well as psychologically.
You said decompensating. What do you mean by that?
I mean, you know, physically, I mean that when I realized that I was literally wasting away, I thought it scared me as a doctor, as a medical doctor, it scared me because I thought I am not in control of this. If I become hospitalized, how much worse is that going to be for my children?
What good am I to them?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And then emotionally, I thought they can't see their mother hysterically crying when they're going through what they're going through. So those two objectives really stayed kind of in the front of my mind immediately and still do.
You know, it's striking to me in reading your book, the degree to which your kids are pillars of strength for you and were unbelievably thoughtful about your well-being. And at the same time, your desperation to figure out a way to kind of minimize they're having to handle your grief and your confusion and your struggles throughout this. You have, as I mentioned earlier, a podcast also titled Life After Suicide. In it, you seems as though you're interviewing a lot of the key players in your life since that time. One of them, Chloe Ashton, your now 19-year-old daughter. In a conversation with you for the Life After Suicide podcast, Chloe explains how she processes Rob's suicide.
The first place my mind went was, why would he do this to me? It's a choice. And I think that a lot of people who go through this experience have that initial thought that this is a choice. This is something that he chose to do. And it really wasn't until the following day when the three of us went to Sue, where
our therapist, Sue Simmering,
where she started explaining, kind of even in the state that we were in, that this is not a choice. This is mental illness. It's a very complex issue.
So you're hearing there from your daughter, kind of working through this as well. There's a special bond, right, between a lot of fathers, a lot of daughters. Rob sound like although a very successful physician himself, mm-hmm. right, surgeon, I think.
Yes, yep.
A thoracic surgeon mm-hmm. here in New York, that he really took a lot of time. She was going to boarding school down in Central Jersey. He made sure to go down there. He'd see her hockey games, spent time with her. There was this thing there that, you know that you can't replace and that you also know that you can't resolved. You know, Chloe says it's a very complex issue. Mm-hmm. And as true as that is, I assume that's desperately unsatisfying, right? There's no single thing where it's like, oh my God, I found this fortune in a cookie and it tells me everything I need to know.
Right. Well, absolutely, David. And I think that my children, who are incredibly compassionate and sensitive with a very high emotional IQ before this happened, I think the biggest reason that they don't have a lot of anger at all towards the world, towards me, towards their father, is because of A, the fact that they've had professional therapy, and B, because they understand that it is an illness no different than cancer or heart disease.
We're discussing the rising suicide rate in the United States, and with the process of living with the grief of loss to suicide, we're discussing it we will be discussing it in a broad way. We're also discussing it in a very human way with Dr. Jennifer Ashton and her own loss. You can join our conversation. How have you been left, and how have you experienced the loss of a loved one who died by suicide? What helped you cope? What set you back? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
ESG, or environmental social governance, challenges businesses to think beyond the immediate bottom line. But before ESG, the Balanced Scorecard did something similar. Questrom's Eddie Riedel explains.
The big thing that was groundbreaking about the Balanced Scorecard is really this idea to move beyond thinking about financial statements, which everybody had thought about since the 1920s, right? That was kind of the gold standard for how to evaluate a company and its performance. And the Balanced Scorecard's big insight, I think, was to get companies internally to think about, well, what if you don't just focus on financial measures? There are other things that are going to affect your performance, and maybe they won't affect them today, but they're going to affect them in the short term, midterm, long term. Building in those other criteria, those other dimensions, and explicitly linking that to your strategy, to how your company is going to operate, what kind of big decisions it's going to make, that's really what the big insight of the Balanced Scorecard was meant to do. And at the time, right now, it doesn't seem particularly revolutionary. It seems kind of obvious. We've been stuck in the ESG movement for a while, and thinking about linking these things to corporate strategy seems pretty obvious. At the time, it was a pretty big whoa kind of moment.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're discussing a painful but important topic, suicide, how the suicide rate is rising in this country, how it affects those who are left behind as well. You can join our conversation. What questions do you have about how to detect warning signs in others or yourselves? How much do you sense that society's stigma against suicide has abated? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. With me is Dr. Jennifer Ashton. She's ABC News' chief medical correspondent and a board-certified OBGYN. Her new book, Life After Suicide, Finding Comfort and Community After Unthinkable Loss. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org, and you can also find resources there on our website should you be concerned about yourself or loved ones as well. I want to take a few calls. People are lining up to weigh in on this with their own circumstances. Elaine is calling from Omaha, Nebraska. Thanks for calling, Elaine.
Thank you for this program, David. My story is very similar. My husband was a school psychologist, and I'm a marriage counselor. And suddenly in 2003, he just announced to me one day that he was walking away from our relationship, which was a 21-year marriage. So, of course, I was devastated, and he moved out of our house just before Christmas. And then at the end of the school year, he moved to another state and lived with another woman. But only about 6 weeks after that, he called and said he was suicidal and couldn't live there and wanted to come home. So, of course, I welcomed him and said I never wanted him to leave. But I could tell that he was very confused and couldn't think his way out of a paper bag. So I urged him to go the very next day, as soon as he got back to Omaha, to a doctor or to a mental health center, which he did. And he was diagnosed with bipolar disorder. So that made everything clear and understandable because all of his behavior had been so atypical of him. He was a very positive, outgoing, loving person, loved his job, was approaching retirement with friends and interests. And so just in like 2007, he announced that he was going to go off his medication because he said his new doctor had told him he didn't have bipolar disorder. And I begged him not to do that because, you know, we knew the statistics about the high suicide rate among bipolar people. But he went off anyway, and that same year, 2007, we were divorced, but we remained very good friends. And then in 2008, he attempted suicide by monoxide poisoning in our garage, which I didn't know about because it didn't work. And by the time I got home, he had called a friend and gone to the hospital. But so I went to see him, and he said, I don't want to live even 5 minutes more. That's the first thing that he said. So I totally understood how desperate he was and how hopeless he felt. And I tried to be a lifeline to him, you know, by calling him every day. And we were going to have ice cream one day. And within about 2 days after that, he jumped from a bridge near our home. So the ironic thing to me is that he and I were both, you know, psychologists, and we have a lot of friends who are therapists and social workers. And he was seeing a therapist, but he never told me what that was about. And none of us, except maybe his therapist, I don't know, knew that this was coming. We didn't see any signs. He didn't have the typical signs of depression. And so I guess my question for anybody who knows out there is, how can we be more perceptive with those people who show no obvious signs of depression and, you know, try to get them help before it's too late?
Thank you for that question, Elaine. Maybe this would be a good time to bring in our second guest. We have with us on the line from Austin, Texas, Dr. Charles Nemeroff. He's professor of psychiatry at the University of Texas, a board member of the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. Dr. Nemeroff, thank you for joining us so much.
Oh, hi, David. It's a pleasure. And I just want to give Dr. Ashton a shout out because what she's doing is so important for people who out there who are suffering in the way she suffered.
And worth noting as well, Dr. Nemiroff, also a board member of the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. What would you say to Elaine, who called in with story herself, a colleague of yours in a sense, a psychiatrist? It sounds like she and her husband were both. How would you answer on that?
Well, first, I think somewhat different from the story that Jennifer described is the caller described her husband having been diagnosed with bipolar disorder, which has a very high rate of suicidality. And he had many of the risk factors that we look at, which didn't sound to be the case of what Dr. Ashton was speaking of. Namely, he had a psychiatric diagnosis of severe mental illness. He was taking medication. He was a male, and men are much more likely to commit suicide than women. And stopping one's medication is often a prelude to one of these terrible events.
Jennifer, what would you say to somebody this call who might be thinking about how does she, you know, she's clearly saying, I didn't see the signs, mm-hmm. right? And you talk in your book a little bit about what it is not to see the signs or think that you should have seen the signs, right?
I think that's, you know, the analogy that I was thinking of as I was listening to Elaine, you know, tell her story, and I'm so sorry, Elaine, for your loss, is that two things. Number one, that's like asking a medical doctor, you know, about someone who's just been diagnosed with terminal cancer. You know, how could we have prevented this? And sometimes in medicine, as much as we know today, we still don't know a lot. So unfortunately, the answer in medicine and science a lot of times is still, we don't know. We're not sure we can prevent this. But my book, because I'm not a mental health professional, as you've said, is about the people who are left in the wake of this, which when you look at the numbers, they are so staggering. It's 47,000 deaths by suicide in the country in 2017, and it's estimated that for every death by suicide, there are 135 people directly affected, like Elaine, like me, like my children. That translates to over 6 million people a year. And so it's for those people that I wanted to share my story and the stories of other survivors so that blame and guilt, like we heard from the caller, don't create a secondary tragedy in the wake of something that's already tragic.
You know, I think David.
Go ahead, Dr. Nemiroff, please.
Jennifer's point about the magnitude of this epidemic. We know and hear a lot about the opiate epidemic. We now know that 20 to 25,000 of those deaths are also suicides. So if you add those 20 to 25,000 to the nearly 50,000 suicides we're going to have this year, we're talking about 75,000 deaths. And if you think about this, there's so many more suicides than homicides. It's just a staggering number.
Right.
Charles, I wanted to ask you about that because in sort of looking through some of the literature in this, I wasn't sure whether it was fair to call this a crisis or an epidemic. A couple of statistics we pulled from the Centers for Disease Control, among others, said latest numbers showed suicide is the 10th leading cause of death in the U.S. for all ages. About 123 Americans die by suicide every day. It takes the lives of roughly 45,000 Americans every year. And the rate has gone up. I looked from 2001, 2015, it had gone up, I think, about 30% if you take the population in aggregate. Obviously, there's some breakdowns to ages, certain kinds of demographics. We can talk about that later. But you use the word epidemic. Why do you select that characterization, Charles?
Well, I think, you know, by and large, the numbers are staggering and the demographics have changed during the years that you described. So in 2000, the vast majority of suicides were elderly men, 70 years of age and older. That's completely changed. In 2017, there was a dramatic increase in the 15 to 34 age group, making it the second leading cause of death in that age group in the United States. And more remarkably, the 24 to 64-year-old age group, it's the fourth leading cause of death. In fact, of the top 10 causes of death in the United States, suicide is the only one that's increasing all the others, heart disease, cancer, stroke, diabetes, are decreasing. Mm-hmm. So that's an epidemic.
Mm-hmm. And also the context of that medically is even more staggering, which is that if you add the opioid deaths that Dr. Nemiroff is just talking about, even if you don't, by the way, 50 to 70,000 deaths by suicide is more people than die of breast cancer and more people that died of AIDS at the peak of the HIV/AIDS epidemic. At the peak.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, Jennifer, the other thing I'd mention that no one ever talks about is there are 500,000 suicide attempts that get to the emergency room every year in the United States.
And it's medicine basically making sure that those don't become a different kind of statistic.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. I want to take a call or two more now. Irene is calling from Richmond, Virginia. Irene, thank you for calling in.
Hi there. Thank you so much for taking my call. I just wanted to say how much I appreciate this conversation surrounding suicide. I think the more that we can talk about it, especially your medical phrasing and framing, you know, putting attention to the fact that we don't blame someone for, you know, being diagnosed with cancer, and yet with someone with mental illness, sometimes there's a lot of question of blaming. I could really relate to your daughter's comment about, you know, feeling at first like it was a choice that someone had made. My father committed suicide when I was 12 years old, and he was, I think, 41 at the time. This was in 2000. And he had been diagnosed bipolar. He had been on and off of medication, in and out of counseling and treatment. And as an added situation that he was kind of dealing with, he was secretly gay. And so he and my mother were living in this situation. I think he felt like he was going to lose, you know, everything that he had, his friends, his status. You know, he had come from a community where that was not accepted. And 2000 wasn't that long ago, but it was just long enough ago that even at that time, he felt like he wasn't able to come out and fully be himself. At that time, I think there was still a lot of, for him personally, shame surrounding the idea of being open about mental illness. And I think the idea about being open about LGBTQ. So I guess I just was calling in to say thank you so much for the conversation. And I guess my thought was about the shame surrounding mental illness and how can we open up that conversation? And people who are suffering from, you know, different communities, whether it be, someone who's diagnosed with, you know, chronic depression or bipolar disorder, someone who's suffering from a traumatic experience, living through trauma, you know, someone coming from an LGBTQ community, the fact that this covers lots of different people from lots of different communities.
Thank you for that, Irene. I appreciate it. Jennifer Ashton, you wrote in your book about not necessarily even understanding that you needed this, but about what became a reliance and need for support systems that emerged for you. Mm-hmm. People showed up. Some people didn't show up.
Right.
What worked for you? What ultimately helped sustain you when you were in a situation not the same as Irene's, but, you know, experiencing staggering loss like this?
Well, I think for me and also for my children, you know, this tragedy really shows you who your true friends are. It shows you the best of people and the worst of people. What worked for us really was pretty simple. You know, it was people just being there, whether it was directly next to us or sending texts without expecting a response back. What worked is the understanding that people have that, you know, this was a major trauma that we all went through, and that, like any trauma, it can have ripple effects that pop up unexpectedly, you know, even in the most unexpected times and situations. What doesn't work is people thinking that just because we've passed the one-year mark, we're quote-unquote fine. What doesn't work is people expressing their anger towards Rob, which we have consciously and subconsciously made a commitment to not play, because it's not productive. And again, we didn't want to make it into a secondary tragedy. And even though anger is a very common and natural response to this, we all feel and believe that it's so destructive to us, and that and ultimately disrespectful to Rob's memory. But
it would seem to me also is that there'd be a moment or a way in which even if people were processing their own anger, friends or relatives or whomever, you're like, I got a lot on my plate now.
Yeah.
I can't privilege your feelings about this to mine, even as I recognize you may legitimately have feelings about this.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that what we learned from therapy, and I put a lot of this, all of it in the book, is that the grief and the trauma that comes after losing a loved one to suicide is different than grief from any other kind of death. And that needs to be taken into account by the people in our inner circle. And so the people who have been helpful to us have taken that into account.
I wanted to let you do a reading from your book, the first reading I pulled out for you. Speaking of plates, you talked about after the death of your ex-husband, Rob, a course of healing and introspection. And you feel like it sounded like you were trying to get at the full range of emotions you were experiencing. Go ahead, Jennifer.
Yeah, this was a major kind of epiphany for me. Let's say you break a plate. Not that I've ever done such a thing, but I have heard that it has been known to happen. You need that plate and you have no choice but to glue it back together. But there's a part of the pattern that you've never really liked. So you decide maybe this is a great time to just get rid of that part. Well, you can try. Obviously, though, if you leave out that part you don't like, you're never going to end up with a whole plate. And anything less than a whole plate is really as useless as no plate at all. I can easily picture that, and it makes sense to me. I've still definitely got work to do on my personal version of reconstructing myself, but I'm getting there, flaws and all, and I'm very, very aware that I'm not who I used to be. So I kind of describe this plate analogy as the plate is now glued together, not so pretty and perfect looking, but it's intact.
So we're going to take some calls when we come back from this break, but very briefly in the time we have left in this segment, what would you say to others who are trying to put lives back together in that way?
That you have to embrace all the imperfections and all the flaws, and in doing so, it doesn't make you weak. It actually can make you stronger.
We're discussing the increasing rate of suicide in the United States, the care available to family and friends of those who have taken their own lives. You can join the conversation. What questions do you have for my guests? How have you been able to comfort or aid someone who has lost someone else to suicide? And we'll talk a little bit about popular culture. Netflix's popular show, 13 Reasons Why, is a plotline about teenage suicide. Academics are debating its ultimate effect on teenagers and suicide risk. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. We're discussing the unsettling rise in suicides in the United States, what is being done to address it, and how it affects people in their own lives. You can join the conversation. What questions do you have about suicide? We can talk about how to detect concerns or signs of them of it in yourself and others, what to do about it. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at onpointradio.org. And I want to point out that not only do we have an excerpt of the book of Dr. Jennifer Ashton, which is called Life After Suicide, Finding Courage, Comfort, and Community After Unthinkable Loss. But we also have resources there from people who have such concerns. With me, as I mentioned in studio, is Dr. Jennifer Ashton, author of that book. Also with me on the line from Austin, Texas, is Dr. Charles Nemeroff, a psychiatrist and professor at the University of Texas Dell Medical School, and a board member of the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. I want to take some of your calls to kick off this segment, however. I want to take a call first from Sarasota, Florida. Megan, go ahead.
Hi. I'm so glad that I'm able to listen to this program. Believe it or not, thanks to my mother who gave me a call from her car and said I should be listening. One of the things that my fiance committed, or I should say, we started saying it was taken with suicide in October, and I was here. And one of the things that we have here is called Survivors of Suicide. It's a group that meets twice every month and is extremely helpful, because one thing that we're all dealing with, that and perhaps you all have spoken about this, is that it's not a traditional death, and I know that you just said that, but it is a traumatic death. In other words, many of us either found the body or were there, and so we're not just dealing with the loss, but we're dealing with the trauma. And trying to speak with anyone who has not experienced anything like that, it is just so different that we don't know quite how to talk with anyone. So meeting with others who have gone through that same trauma and just trying to process has been extremely helpful, at least for me, because it really was. It was like a bomb went off in my life. There was just frag everywhere, and I just trying in this process,
this was,
and I'm only six.
This sounds like it was incredibly constructive for you, Megan.
It's very constructive for me, because I have been able to, you know, process out loud with some others who have gone through the same thing and going through the same emotion. So, you know, I would encourage anyone else in any other city that if they've gone through something like this, to try to find it's, you know, because it's not just wives and husbands in grief, you know, because there are all those types of groups with hospice, et cetera, but an actual survivors of suicide type of group is really helpful.
Well, thank you, Megan, for your insight, for sharing for your experience. We, of course, so sorry to hear of what happened. We've also got a call from Portland, Maine. Steve is calling. Go ahead, Steve.
Yes, hi, and thanks for taking the call, and appreciate this conversation, which is really important. I just wanted to share some of what helped me survive, and that was advice from a counselor. Some people, probably like me, grew up in a religious tradition, you know, where it's considered a mortal sin if somebody takes their life, and also is seen as a choice. And I talked to a very wise counselor who, you know, made it clear to me that God was really grieving, and you know, from that perspective, it was just very helpful. Thank you.
Thank you for sharing that and for sharing that sense of community with others. And one call as well from Wakota, South Dakota, Sarah. Go ahead, share your questions for our guests.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. June 27th of 2017, my daughter committed suicide. And it's still hard for me to wrap my head around that it's coming on to 2 years. I live very rurally in rural South Dakota. I was here and she was living in Florida. She's 29. And I don't have a support system here. I don't know how to heal myself, because I just don't. There's nothing here for me. My husband and I obviously are devastated, and he's not a very good communicator sometimes, so I cry a lot. I walk with my dogs, and I talk to her, and I just cry all the time, and it's almost 2 years. I don't know if I'm doing something wrong. I'm not angry with her. I understand, and I should have seen the writing on the wall. I should have been more...
Well, Sarah, why don't you stay on the line for a moment, and let's turn to Charles Nemiroff, who is a psychiatrist who talks about these things. You know, I think as mentioned in Jennifer's book, Dr. Jennifer Ashton's book about her own experience, that, you know, people think, well, you get through the year. I think you even just mentioned it a moment ago, Jennifer, that you're fine, and actually there's this realization that it's not fine. Charles Nemiroff, what kinds of advice would you offer someone like Sarah, who's gone through, I guess, almost 2 years now, and who's trying to figure out how to move forward, and who's still in a sense of shock?
So, Sarah, first, my heart goes out to you. I've taken care of many patients, and I've lost some to suicide. And I've counseled many, many individuals who have gone through this loss. First, I would recommend that you get in touch, get online, look at the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, AFSP.org, or the Anxiety and Depression Association of America. They can put you in touch with resources, yes, even in South Dakota. And we have chapters there where you could deal with the issue a little better by being embraced by survivors, a bit like the previous caller talked about. But there is help for you. I also wanted to make a point that Jennifer made, and I want to highlight it. And that is, people who commit suicide are in so much psychic pain that they're hurting so badly that life becomes agony, and they're both helpless and hopeless. Now, many could be helped if they receive treatment, and there's a lot of obstacle, as you all know. There's stigma, there's difficulty with third-party payers, et cetera. But I always tell the medical students, you know, no one growing up volunteers to be somebody that in the end is going to commit suicide. This is as terrible a hand to be dealt as diabetes or, as Jennifer mentioned earlier, terminal cancer.
And Jennifer, go ahead.
Yeah, I also, you know, in listening to Sarah and the fact that she cries every day and it's coming up on 2 years, I learned from therapy that grief is love. So when you lose someone you love, it is not only normal but healthy to grieve that loss, but that there is this phenomenon called complicated grief, which is if you don't get some professional therapy or support, that can persist and can interfere, you know, in your recovery and your healing. And I also learned, and my children learned with therapy, and it's in the book with another survivor story, a concept or a theory that was developed in the 1990s by two psychologists called post-traumatic growth, and that it's inconceivable when you're in as much pain as the last caller was in to imagine a situation where your life is actually in many ways better. But in dealing with a trauma, it can be an opportunity for a deeper appreciation of life, enriched relationships with other people. Sometimes that involves spiritual change, but that is possible. And I hope that our last caller gets to that point.
And Sarah, I think you're still on the line. Does what Charles or Jennifer offer you any leads, any guides of things that you can do that feel constructive in this moment?
Well, it does. I've looked online and I've tried to get into these, groups of people talking about their grief online. And I don't know if it's something that's going to be cathartic for me in any way. I just feel worse. I don't know how to explain it. I'm a very spiritual person and I appreciate beautiful things and the countryside. And I just miss my daughter so terribly, and I know that she was hurting. She suffered from anxiety and depression, but she had so much to live for. She was so beautiful and bright and smart, and when I can't spell something, I have no one to call anymore, you know? Like, I'll do what I can. I'm going to have to go and buy the doctor's book.
Well, it sounds like it's some of the resources that have been offered you in this conversation would be, I hope, of some help. Thank you so much for sharing your experiences and your grief. Of course, you miss her. Dr. Nemiroff, what do you say to offer those people who say, I didn't see the signs? I think in speaking to my colleagues before the show that you'd said, look, there have been patients of yours where one or two of them had taken their own lives, and you had not registered that that was a likely consequence.
No, they weren't even on my worry list. You know, all psychiatrists have patients on their worry list, and three patients that I've lost in the last 2 years completely blindsided me. And I think that there are fundamentally two different kinds of suicides. One is the kind of person who's suffered for a long time with a known psychiatric illness, bipolar disorder, depression, for example, and they just don't get better for whatever reason. They don't get the right treatment. They haven't availed themselves of any treatment. And they finally sort of decide that they've had enough. The other kind is the impulsive suicide. These are often occurs in adolescence. And as you know, adolescence is a time of very deep feelings and great hurts. And, you know, our society with all the social media is sort of set up for this, cyberbullying, et cetera. And many times young people will have a terrible hurt, you know, be ostracized from a social group, be embarrassed in school, be humiliated about not having a date at the prom, and they will impulsively decide to take their life. So it's extremely difficult to pick up on the warning signs. There is the sort of classic notion, if somebody calls you and says, I'm going to give away all of my belongings, and I want to make a donation to, you know, the charity of your choice, and I just want to tell you what a great friend you've been. Well, that's a warning sign, but it rarely happens that way.
Charles Nemiroff, you talked a little bit about impulsive decisions. Let's talk a little bit about popular culture. And I think the best way to do it might be through talking about the Netflix show 13 Reasons Why. The show is built around the mystery of the suicide of its main character named Hannah. In this extra segment, the series creator Brian Yorkey talked about the show's depiction of Hannah's suicide.
We had a number of people ask us along the way why we had Hannah kill herself in the way we did and why we showed it. We worked very hard not to be gratuitous, but we did want it to be painful to watch because we wanted it to be very clear that there is nothing in any way worthwhile about suicide.
Charles Nemiroff, you're active on the board of the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. There was a study out that said from the National Institute of Mental Health, a federal research agency, with findings saying that that they thought that it could likely influence teenagers to take their lives. And yet there's another study out from the University of Pennsylvania that showed that suicide risk decreased for students who watched 13 Reasons Why all the way through to the end of season two. But that students who stopped in the middle, there seemed to be a strong suggestion, were at a higher risk of suicide. What degree of influence do you ascribe to popular culture episodes like this?
Well, I think it has a tremendous impact. And I have to tell you that in our own observations, when I was at the University of Miami, when this show first aired, we showed a large increase in the number of adolescent patients who were coming in with either attempted suicide or plans to commit suicide. So I think the NIMH study was very well done, and we know that there is a phenomenon of suicide contagion among adolescents, that there are clusters of suicides that occur at particular high schools. After there's one, there's another. This has also been documented in veterans who serve in the same unit overseas. There is a clustering of suicides. And I think the way I look at it is that there are a multitude of factors that either raise or lower one's threshold for suicide. And they conspire to either bring one to threshold or not. And that has to do with social support systems, using drugs or alcohol, cyberbullying, et cetera. And I think this is just one additional factor that is a main contributor, particularly in young people.
One of the things I struck about Jennifer Ashton as we wrap up this hour was some advice you got from Dr. Sue Simmering, both reflected in your book and in your podcast. She says, people ask themselves, how can I be strong and weak? How can I be happy and sad? People make the mistake of thinking it's either or, that I'm strong or I'm weak. I'm really in shock or I'm having a good time. Once you embrace multiple truths, you've got to recognize it's and.
Yeah, the concept of multiple truths, which I talk about in the book, and something else I learned from therapy is if you want to heal, you have to feel. And that has been really hard, but also really freeing and really helpful for me and my children. You know, once you can admit these things to yourself, you can admit them to other people.
That's Dr. Jennifer Ashton, ABC News chief medical correspondent, author of Life After Suicide. Thank you for sharing your experiences for this moving hour today.
Thank you.
And also, we'd like to thank Dr. Charles Nemeroff, professor of psychiatry at the University of Texas Dell Medical School. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Again, if you have concerns that you or someone you may know may be considering taking his or her life, please contact the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-8255 or the Crisis Text Line by texting 741-741. You can continue the conversation, get the On Point podcast, our website, onpointradio.org. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
ESG, or environmental social governance, challenges businesses to think beyond the immediate bottom line. But before ESG, the Balanced Scorecard did something similar. Questrom's Eddie Riedel explains.
The big thing that was groundbreaking about the Balanced Scorecard is really this idea to move beyond thinking about financial statements, which everybody had thought about since the 1920s, right? That was kind of the gold standard for how to evaluate a company and its performance. And the Balanced Scorecard's big insight, I think, was to get companies internally to think about, well, what if you don't just focus on financial measures? There are other things that are going to affect your performance, and maybe they won't affect them today, but they're going to affect them in the short term, midterm, long term. Building in those other criteria, those other dimensions, and explicitly linking that to your strategy, to how your company is going to operate, what kind of big decisions it's going to make, that's really what the big insight of the Balanced Scorecard was meant to do. And at the time, right now, it doesn't seem particularly revolutionary. It seems kind of obvious. We've been stuck in the ESG movement for a while, and thinking about linking these things to corporate strategy seems pretty obvious. At the time, it was a pretty big whoa kind of moment.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.